To my brothers in Earth and Grave and our loyal Grave Dwellers family, this one's for you. That's the dedication that Rachel Barton Pine has inscribed on her new album of violin concertos, recorded in collaboration with metal-inspired composer Earl Manin. It is with such immense delight that I welcome Rachel and Earl onto our classical conversations today. Thank you both for sharing your time with us.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us.
I've made a Venn diagram with three different sets, one labeled violinist, another labeled metalhead, and a third classical musician. In the center, I have Rachel Barton Pine and Earl Manin. So you both have so much in common. Was it one of those shared passions that brought you together in the first place, or how did you meet?
Yeah, well, the world of electric heavy metal violin is incredibly small. I think there are like five or six of us in the U.S., and Earl and I had actually not met, but I was a fan of his no-guitar metalcore band called Resolution 15. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be great? And I knew that he wrote all the songs for Resolution 15. I thought, wouldn't it be great if he wrote something that was like this kind of music before the regular old four-string acoustic violin that I could use for classical recital programs? And of course, there's a long tradition of this in classical music, whether you're talking about Bartok using Hungarian folk music in his art music, or Dvorak with Czech folk music, all the composers who've incorporated elements of jazz, et cetera, et cetera. So I thought, you know, this is something that needs to be done, especially because metal as a overview of lots of genres, so many of the subgenres of metal have actually been inspired by classical. So we need to have classical inspired by metal that was inspired by classical, etc. So Earl's music was just so gripping and unique, and I really wanted to be able to play some of it myself in concert. So I asked him to write me an unaccompanied piece, and it was an amazing piece. And I ended up performing it I premiered it at a recital in New York, and conductor Tito Munoz, music director of the Phoenix Symphony, was in the audience and liked it so much that, long story short, there's a little more complicated than this, but the end result was that he asked Earl to write a violin concerto for the Phoenix Symphony and me. I've since performed it in France. Of course, we recorded it with the orchestra in Scotland, Royal National Scottish Orchestra. So, it's just been an amazing journey. And the concerto turned out it's really a dream come true. Let's put it that way. Like the concerto that I always wanted to exist, and now it does.
Yeah. So that the concerto became Dependent Arising. Right. I'm so excited that you are sharing this as or that you're building this bridge between the classical and metal worlds. On either side, we have the Shostakovich violin concerto, on the other, Earl, your violin concerto. As I was going through the program notes, I was coming across a lot of different metal terminology that I think would be very helpful for us to have a really solid familiarity with before we get more into that connection. So Earl, I was wondering if you could tell us more about some of those terms. I was seeing things like mosh and breakdown and blast beats, chugs and rubs. What do those mean?
Okay, so moshing is basically a sort of a very aggressive kind of dancing. It's the old school stuff was more like pogoing, like if you would go to like a hardcore punk show, like people would just sort of jump up and down and kind of like slam into each other, but it wasn't necessarily that violent.
What's amazing is that it erupts like spontaneously, but like the collective is of one mind. It frightens my husband a little, not the action of the moshing, but like the fact that everybody can become a mob or something. but I think it's a beautiful thing that humanity can like become this one collective force. And like when the music changes tempo, like speeds up, slows down, like there are moments where it just is like built to inspire moshing to, have this outbreak. And, it's great to be down in the crowd and doing it. It's even more fulfilling for me, at least, somehow, to be on the stage and have my performance cause this to happen. The first time I ever did that with my band, it was just like amazing, because it's, certainly not something you're going to experience in a classical performance. And the power of that to to move the audience to that degree. I think it actually, in a way, made me a better performer of any of the music that I play, even the most delicate and serene classical, just to realize that I need to, just put myself, just really inhabit everything I'm doing and somehow reach out to the entire crowd all the way to the back to get them caught up in what's happening, even if what's happening is like peacefulness.
Do you find similar eruptions in the Shostakovich concerto?
Oh my God, for sure. Like at the end of the last movement where it suddenly kicks in, like that would totally cause a mosh pit to happen in the right circumstances.
Oh, I wanted to add one more thing. A breakdown is when the tempo suddenly slows. So let's say you're going at like 220 to the quarter, right? And then without a ritardando, without any warning, it just drops to 90. And then like, so you get this like sudden jolt. It's a sudden tempo shift. And everybody knows, a metal fan, a metalhead will know that when the band does that, it's time to dance. So that's when things really, really erupt.
Interesting. I would be curious to hear Shostakovich himself talking about it in this manner, right? What is, I think we can't separate Shostakovich from his historical place. Could you just give us a little more context about the environment he was in when he composed that concerto?
So Shostakovich was under censure. Shostakovich, Khachaturian, Prokofiev, like a lot of big Soviet composers were denounced as something called formalist. It was just sort of like the term Stalin used to kind of just say, I don't like you, I don't like your music, and if you keep on writing like this, I'm gonna kill you. Because he wanted to stay alive, Shostakovich did not make public the concerto at the time it was written. He shelved it. It was one of his sort of secret works, like sort of desk drawer works. And when you hear it, it's very clear as to why. I mean, there's a lot of klezmer elements. That's an example. That's where he's basically speaking truth to power in this concerto, I believe. You know, there's klezmer elements, particularly the second movement, and that is in direct a contradiction to Stalin's anti-Semitic doctor's plot policies at the time.
Yeah, he had a number of those things, right? Like the Babi Yar symphony and the eighth string quartet. Like, he wasn't Jewish himself, but he obviously was, I guess what we would call a social justice person, because he was like, hey, you shouldn't be like discriminating against and like literally killing someone for their ethnicity. And his music was expressing that, which is amazing.
So we're keeping in mind Shostakovich as the social justice person in a time of terror and oppression. And we hear a lot of gut-wrenching sorts of emotions in his concerto. And I think when I listen to your concerto, Earl, some descriptors that come to mind are raw and visceral. It's not sugarcoating anything, I don't think. It faces some dark ideas head on, but there's still this sense of catharsis. Could you tell us a little bit more about the inspiration behind your different movements?
So let's see, there's three threads really that tie the concerto together. There's the sort of metal influence, where I'm drawing very much on the language of heavy music. Metal, hardcore, a lot of hardcore punk and thrash and like all the subgenres of stuff that exist in metal. From my training as a Western classical player, a violinist, and also my practice as a Buddhist and kind of how I get by this life, what I do internally to kind of like move on with my day. So basically the first move is called Grasping at the Self. I mean, it's not exactly like point for point for point for point, right? I didn't write program music, right? It's not necessarily a story, but it's called Grasping at the Self because part of what I wanted to convey was every person's sort of ego grasping. This is my like internal, like I'm always being dictated to by my needs and how we internally suffer in this way. The second movement has a long title. It's called The Crows Already Knew of Your Grief and They Will Carry Him home, and that was written in response to a very good friend of mine who had died of kidney cancer. It wasn't part of the concerto, but like some years ago, he had died of kidney cancer. I had thought of the theme the day I came home from the funeral, and it was just sort of sitting on my hard drive, and I purposed it for the concerto to kind of like write about the visceral grieving process. And then the third one is the title is actually just a quote from the Heart Sutra, Gate Gate Para Gate Para Sam Gate Bodhisoha, and that's loosely translated, it means just keep going until you reach enlightenment, until you fully understand your own internal delusions, and thus suffering ceases. So, and the language I use for that one is also, I'm trying to draw on the Buddhist concept of wrath as a transformational tool. Wrath not in terms of a Western, like this sort of, I'm angry at you, I'm raging against you, but wrath almost like a mother who sees her child like about to touch the hot stove, and the mom slaps the hand and goes, hey, watch that, please, you're gonna get burnt, don't touch that.
And the title of the concerto, Dependent Arising, I understand that has some Buddhist inflections as well. Could you tell us more about that?
Dependent Arising is actually the like Buddhism in a nutshell. It's the understanding that nothing exists independent of itself. Like there's nothing that happens or exists from its own side, so to speak. Everything is connected to each other.
This is definitely music that makes us stop and think. It's sometimes makes us uncomfortable. It expresses some of the more challenging aspects of life. And I would be interested to hear both of your perspectives on some of the benefits of listening to music that is so extremely honest about those challenges in life.
Yeah, gosh, you know, sometimes as a person of faith, I compare it to praying the Psalms, that you're crying out with a loud voice, that, you know, there are so many misconceptions about metal. First of all, we should clarify that we're not talking about party metal, like the glam genres that were on mainstream radio in the 80s or whatever, where it's all about girls and debauchery. Like that's not the kind of metal we're talking about. We're talking about, you know, the more serious underground genres that wouldn't have been on the top 40. I mean, gosh, the opening track of the fourth album of Metallica is about environmentalism, for example. You know, it's talking about the circumstances of life. So lyrically, as well as in terms of the music itself, these genres are quite different from their more cheesy cousins, so to speak. But you know, it's when you see people throwing the horns, that typical metal hand gesture, they're not saying "Hail Satan," they're saying "Be gone, Satan," and that's actually where that hand gesture derives from. And you know, similarly, when there's this expression of violence, it's a catharsis. It's not embracing violence. It's using violence as a cleansing tool, and this aggression and this intensity. And you know, in much the same way of, you know, the bombast of some of the great 19th century symphonies, whether you're talking about, you know, Mahler or Bruckner, you know, there's a real connection there. And yeah, it kind of actually makes you feel, well, happy is too light a word, but yeah, it brings joy in the end, actually, to work through some of this darker stuff.
Thank you for that clarification. Earl, would you say that rings true for you as well?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. That's, I mean, like Rachel basically said what I was going to say. That's how I choose to use metal. And that's how Rachel obviously chooses to use metal. It's like a drug, right? Like where if I'm sick,
I wouldn't know.
Right. So like, well, or prescription medicine or whatever. Like if you're sick, you take this drug. Now it's not a good or a bad thing. It's a thing, right? And it does X or Y to the body. There are definitely people who use this sort of energy to be destructive. Like they're taking these sort of negative emotions and instead of using the power to kind of release, they use it for other ends. But that's certainly not how I choose to use this music. And that's certainly not how Rachel chooses to use this music, I'm absolutely using it as catharsis. All the shows that I've been to, the bands that I like, all the stuff I grew up listening to, that's the effect, that you go there and we are almost as if we are one organism. Like, that's what we had mentioned earlier, that it's this sort of almost joyful. Yeah,
it's empowering. It's celebrating when you go and everybody's like, Slayer. And it's just like, yeah, just collective elation.
Thinking of empowering, were there any moments in the recording process that stand out to you as being especially memorable in terms of music making?
I'll let Earl talk about his own composition, but for me as the performer, it was brilliant to see. You know, you can just assume, and I think you'd be correct, that most, if not all, of the members of the Royal Scottish National Orchestra don't necessarily go home at night and turn on their favorite death metal albums. So it wasn't that they were familiar with the roots of where this music was coming from, but Earl had, you know, worked so hard through various trials and errors to put on the page, you know, something that would tell you from the music itself how the music should be. And you know, and then of course our conductor, Maestro Munoz, was just so brilliant in, you know, in a very expeditious way as the clock is running, you know, getting everybody to play it the way it's supposed to sound. And I think there was an excitement in the room when everybody heard something happening that was unlike any music they'd ever experienced before. I mean, people seemed super energized and I've been so gratified that that's also been the experience of many people who've been hearing the album thus far, friends and colleagues. And they're like, whoa, that was so amazing. And I've never heard a violin concerto like that. And it was awesome. And so that's been really cool.
I think if that doesn't entice listeners to go and listen to it, I don't know what will, because I'm hearing the excitement and passion in your voice. And that comes through the music too. But for you, Earl, what was that most memorable moment?
Well, I just couldn't believe that I got there. It was like a whole draw. I don't need to go into the whole thing, but I actually got COVID like 4 days before I was supposed to go to Scotland for the recording. And I just couldn't believe that I recovered and managed to get, there were so many moving parts that when, if you remember at that time, right? Like Omicron was like hitting. And there were all these crazy contingencies, like what if the bassoonist got sick? What's the orchestra going to do if so-and-so gets sick? If blah, blah, blah. If Rachel, God forbid, or Tito, like what would happen? Like, was this going to happen? So I got it. In a weird way, I already wrote it. I'm like the least important dude. Like I don't really need to be there. But for it to kind of manifest in this way, I never thought that it was going to be like this. So it's just really dream come true. So it's the whole thing, really.
It sounds like the stars just really aligned for you for this project. I'm so glad they did. Are there any other tidbits that we should definitely know before we sign off and go listen to Dependent Arising?
Well, you know, you'd mentioned blast beats, and I think it's fascinating when Earl explains what that is in a metal band and how he made it work with orchestral timpani and percussion and strings and winds. And because we made the choice early on not to bring in like a drum kit to the orchestra, because that would have just been too loud, and then you would have had to mute things and amplify things, and it would have just been this whole can of worms. And there was something really awesome about just being able to take a normal symphony orchestra and make it into a metal machine. But then there were certain very characteristic or idiomatic things that a drum kit could have easily done, that then it was like, okay, how the heck am I going to replicate that, or not replicate, but have the same effect?
Right. So thank you, Rachel. So a blast beat is basically on a drum set, it's kick, snare, and crash, or hi-hat if it's open, depending on like the texture of the song that's happening, all playing in unison very quickly. And it depends on how you notate it. You could say they're 32nd notes. You could say they're 16th notes. Like, you know, but just they're repeated and they're in unison, which is, as you can imagine, it's kind of difficult.
Right, because you're used to chuck, 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 but this is like,
like
that. Yeah, there you go.
All with one hand doing the 32nd notes all together, and the feet. So all the feet are kind of, everybody's in unison, all your limbs are in unison. super virtuosic. So to kind of pull it into orchestra land, there were sections where I could have the snare or the or each percussionist kind of do it, but I also didn't want to drown Rachel out. So like there was like all these weird orchestration lessons I had to learn.
Yeah, and making them do it with one hand, because if you do it with alternating hands, it might be the same thing that's on the page, but the effect is a totally different intensity.
Right. I got pushback from percussionists, actually, when I was like, no, this is all your right hand. And then they were like, well, this makes no sense. This will be certainly this is certainly easier and better to just right, left, right, left, right, left. So I'm like, no. I actually, and even in drummers who do this, the part of the emotional affect is that it's hard to do and you're doing it really fast. So there's a natural tension that's present in the hand when you're going with one hand. So that also, when you hear that tension in the player actually doing it, it affects it and it gives you, it adds that feeling of, this doesn't feel good in a good way, in the way that you're supposed to not feel good, because that's what the music is trying to tell you. So I got pushback and we had to kind of, it was a multi-layered solution. Some of it, we insisted on it and we made it happen. Other things went during the rewrites when Rachel would get drowned out. Sometimes I would do it with horns. I took it out of percussion, but I had other instruments play this sort of effect. So snap hits from the strings, sometimes collegno, things like that. So the solution ended up multi-layered.
Thank you so much for elaborating that. I mean, I feel like that gives us a really good anchor point. And actually, this whole conversation gives us a great launching point for listening to this entire album. So I want to thank you both, Rachel and Earl, for speaking with me today, and know that we will very happily continue to follow your careers ahead. Thanks again.
Thanks for having us.